Well, one of the things that, I thought we might do, you know, was talk about the 50s. Like, you, that was a good introduction there. And then Buddy and Joanne.
I remember James.
Buddy and, oh, James Drinkwater.
Yeah.
Buddy and Joanne Panzer were the first members of NA ever in 1953.
Cool.
And I went to school with them, too. Marilyn Von Henschel, Buddy and Joanne Panzer. And then Paul and Scott and Roger, you know, what's her name last night was talking about, Fawn was talking about on the railroad tracks, you know, the thing. Well, that was Paul and Scott were there and Jimmy trying to look at the Sputnik, you know. Now, I wasn't there. That was 58 or 59. But Scott was the oldest member of NA. He came in 54, stayed clean till 59. And then he went out and used again. And then he went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. In 62, he was there when I came. And then he was still going in and out, in and out. And then Pepe, I moved to Oregon. Pepe moved to Northern California. Scott moved to Oregon a little ways from me, which came the kick at my house up there. Pepe came up. And so anyway, that was sort of something that went on there. But Scott Cronlin is a very significant guy. And one of the pictures there that they were showing at noon yesterday showed Scott's house, you know.
Oh, yeah, I think I saw that, right?
And so Scott, as far as we know, is on Skid Row, probably dead now, you know. And, of course, Paul's dead. And Roger was a guy that was connected with Scott, Paul, and Jimmy and from the early days. And he lived close to where Scott lived. And he was there when I came. After a few months, he had cut himself with a chainsaw, went to the doctor. The doctor put him on morphine and all kind of stuff, and he couldn't get off of it. And one night he went out and snuffed himself with the exhaust in his car, you know. So anyway, and then, but Bill and Zona, see, nobody ever talks about this, Bill and Zona. In 1962, there was two meetings in Los Angeles area. One was at Rosa Moore Park in Studio City. The other one was at Bill Azona's place in Burbank. Bill was a Jewish guy and Zona was a black guy. Now, we met there, I don't know, for a couple of years, you know, and that was sort of a laid-back meeting. They had an apartment and they had there was a little swimming pool in the back, you know, that they were renting this place. And so we would meet outside most of the time. The winter time we'd meet inside. But Bill finally went back to the penitentiary, to CRC. And one of the guys seen him there, and he just had tears in his eyes, you know, because he wanted to come back. And he said, when I get out, I'm coming back. But he never came back. And Zona went out and used again, and she got murdered. And but see, nobody talks about that. That's NA history.
Well, not only is it NA history, but, you know, it brings something home that people aren't interested in looking at today, and that's the fact that this disease is no joke.
Well, what we're going to do is now we're going to officially interview. Hi, my name is Biff, and I'm an addict. And this is the 50th Anniversary History Conference, and Nashville, Tennessee, October 3rd through the 5th, 2003. The recordings from this conference belong to the public domain, and the next speaker is Gene H.
Right.
From Oregon. And I've heard Gene now a couple of times since I met him out in San Diego. You know, I heard of him, but then again, you know, we've all heard of him. And Gene's been in the fellowship since 1962, but what we're going to talk about, at least initially, Gene, is that we were talking earlier, and although you came in 62 and you met some of the folks at that point, you found out a lot about the earlier history from the people who were there at that time, and found out that you knew a lot more about NA and some of the people involved in it than you thought you had, and could you tell us a little bit about that and take it from there into your first meeting in the 60s and what those meetings were like in 62 when you got here?
Yeah, I've been glad to do that, Biff. It's sort of exciting for me because realizing that I knew more about NA and I was involved in the people involved in NA in 1953 when I was in high school, and I went to high school with a girl by the name of Marilyn von Henschel. And Marilyn, she invited me to her home, and her father, we found out, was a musician and had been a drug addict, and now he was clean. And so we talked about that a little bit, and I was still using. Then I went to high school with a couple other kids, Buddy and Joanne Panzer, brother and sister. And actually, Buddy and Joanne were the first active members of Narcotics Anonymous in 1953. And Buddy stayed clean for a few months. Joanne never did. And after Buddy used again, they never came back. And 1954, so I knew Buddy and Joanne Panzer. I knew Marilyn von Henschel. But I never heard the name N.A. or Narcotics Anonymous. I didn't hear it. But I knew that they were doing something involving with people staying clean. And also at that time, a movie director by the name of Cy Maless was involved. And Gil von Henschel was involved. There was actually three people in probably 52 and 53. It was Jimmy Kinnon, Gil von Henschel, and Cy Maless. And they were all strong-willed guys. And I met all three of them. But Jimmy was the strongest will of all of them. And so he won out. And the other guys went off in other directions. As far as I know, they both Cy and Gil, you know, stayed clean and until they died. I know Cy Maless died in Studio City a few years ago. Gil von Henschel, I talked to him about 20, 25 years ago, and I don't know what's going on with him now. But that was sort of the beginning. Then in 1954, there was a fellow by name of Scott Cromlin. And Scott was in a unique position because he was the first addict that was clean for any significant time. And he stayed clean from 1954 until 1959. He had 5 years clean, and that was pretty impressive. And he was very close to Jimmy. They were together all the time. In fact, in a video about Jimmy and about the Dad's Club and Shire's Dryer and all that, there was a picture of Scott's house there in Burbank. And they were talking about Scott and Paul Stewart and Jimmy were trying to look at the find a Sputnik in the middle of the night, and they were laying out on the railroad tracks there, and Jimmy made the comment that he thought that they were all jacked up on Coke or Benny's or something, because he was tired as he could be, and those guys were just wide awake. So anyway, but that was Scott Cronin and Paul Stewart, Paul was clean about, was in and out about that time, and then there was another fellow by the name of Russ Counts. So it was basically Scott, Russ, and Paul Stewart at around 59, 58, 59, and those guys were in and out during those years until 1962. In 1962, I came in March the 25th, and Scott was there, Russ was there, Paul was there, and also Pepe was in and out from about 59 too. Seems like there was sort of an influx of people in 1959, between 59 and 62, there was a lot of activity with people coming and going in NA, but nobody could quite stay clean. But these people all ended up in 1962 in the same place. And it was, I don't know if it was a spiritual awakening or what happened, but the only people that were involved from NA that stayed clean and are clean today were people that were clean in 1962. Nobody prior to that had stayed clean and is clean today. So that's 1962 now. And somebody mentioned about yesterday there were maybe it was Sally or Fawn, I don't know, it was Fawn talking about an influx of people from New York because NA wasn't functioning there and they heard about NA in California and they came out. And at my first meeting, there was three guys and a girl, all from New York, Mel, Ben, and Herb, and a woman, I don't remember what her name was. And my sponsor at that time, Paul Stewart, knew them and they were coming together to the meetings. Mel, Ben, and Herb and the woman, they were around for a couple months, but they never stuck it out, and nobody's heard from them since. But at that time, 1962, I think it's a general opinion of NA that the mother group on Roads and Moore Park was the only meeting in existence at that time. But that's not true. There was another meeting at Bill and Zona's place. Bill was a Jewish guy, and Zona was a black lady, a very nice couple, very dedicated to the program. And we met at their place in Burbank. They had a small, and so this Rhodes and Moore Park was a church, so that was sort of a formal setting. But Bill and Zona's was very informal. They had an apartment, like a studio apartment, where the bed was in the living room, and that's all it was, and a kitchen and a living room with a bed. And probably there was maybe a dozen people in NA at that time, and so it was big enough for us. And so we'd sit around and meet there, and it was very, very comfortable, sort of low-key, and people's hearts seemed to pour out more in that kind of a setting than they did in a more formal setting. Then they had a little, small little swimming pool in the back, and in the summertime when the weather was good, we used to sit around there and have the meeting, and it was a very comfortable, inspiring situation. Well, both types of meetings were very good. They both had a purpose. And one of the things that we always did, the fellowship was very tight and very trustful. We trusted each other a lot, and we met together, and I don't think we ever went home, directly home after a meeting. We always went to a restaurant someplace or maybe somebody's house. But there was one place in Studio City there called Johnny's. It was a restaurant, and we met there for years, I think, from starting in 1962. And I mean, there'd be 10, 15 people there at Johnny's, and there was always people that didn't have any money just came in, and we would feed them, and it was just a good time of fellowship and of giving and receiving, you know. Anyway, about that time, 1962, I think 1963, there was, in 62, then Penny Kennedy was there. Penny was a nurse and a very good friend of Jimmy Kennan. They were really tight. They were always talking together, working together, and Penny was a good friend of Jimmy's wife, his first wife, who had died a few years later, but Penny had a hard time. She was a nurse, and she got her license back, and she began to work in a hospital again, and that was the worst thing that happened. She should have done janitorial work or house cleaning or something, but she started using again, and she was sort of off and on, Well, anyway, so that was Penny Kennedy. She was there in 62. And So anyway, about that time then, oh, and there was another fella, Phil Phillips, we call him Slick Phil. And Slick Phil was double hip, double slick, and his story's in a book someplace there, I'm not sure which one it is. But he was pretty slick, and he was a lot different than the rest of us. But he was clean. And he, after a few years, Phil got sick with arthritis, and he wasn't feeling well. And then he sort of moved away, and we never seen him again. He came through Oregon about 15 years ago, and he called, and I wasn't home, and he was on his way to Alaska. And as far as I know, now, Slick Phil was there before I came. And I think he would be, if he's still alive and if he's still clean, he would be the oldest member of NA that was on the streets and attending that meeting. And then I would probably be the next oldest member that stayed clean. And Sylvia W. then came in, I think maybe in June of 62, and she's still clean, and she's done a wonderful job, and her four brothers trickled in from time to time after that, and they're still clean. So there was quite an influx there in 1962 of people that have had some stability and are still clean and sober. And anyway, but about that time, it was either late, oh, and Pepe Acuna. Pepe was there when I came in 1962, and then he was in and out a little bit, and then he went to Suriname, and he stayed there from early 1962 until December. And he got out, he took off from there. They didn't want him to leave, but he took off and couldn't stand it there anymore because sort of attack therapy. And he went home, and they didn't want him at his home, and he came back to N.A., and Pepe stayed clean until he died in 1987, I think, or right around there. And Pepe was a very dedicated guy. He moved to Northern California in the 70s, and I was in Oregon. We were about 135 miles away, and at that time, Scott Cronin, the first member, had moved to Oregon, about 100 miles north of me, and so Pepe and I got together and went to visit Scott, and he was still using it, and he came down to my place and stayed with me for a while and kicked, and so Pepe and I stayed pretty close with Scott, but Scott couldn't keep it up. And Scott had a radio program there. He's playing jazz. There's things that he wanted to do. He had a good job with the federal government. He had everything that he thought he wanted, but it wasn't enough. And as far as we know now, last time we heard, he was down Skid Row someplace. And I doubt if he's alive at this point.
There's a couple of things that come to mind then. You talked about this couple that had their meeting at Burbank. Could you give us an idea about, you know, what happened to them, what happened to that meeting and everything else? And also, it sounds like NA spread by that core group in 62 moving.
Right.
Was that the way that NA grew, or were there other ways that NA grew from those two groups that started, that were functioning and solid in 1962?
They grew because people started attending our meetings there at Bill and Zona's and Rhodes and Moore Park from out of town. But Bill and Zona, I think their meeting went on for a couple years, and then the meeting stopped. Bill went out, started using again, ended up at CRC, the penitentiary there, and we were holding meetings out there that time in Corona, and the fellas went out there and they said Bill had tears in his eyes because he wanted to come back and he was waiting to come back, and but he never did. And we don't know what happened to him, but Zona eventually was murdered a couple years later, which was pretty sad because these people were Bill and Zona were key people in the beginning of NA, and we loved them a lot, and they did a lot for the program. The next one of the next fellows that came was a fellow by the name of Lou Eccles, and Lou lived in Long Beach, which was a long way from Studio City, and so he was very dedicated about coming to the meetings there, but he wanted to start one at his place, so he started a meeting in Long Beach, was probably about 30 miles from where we were, but we went out, I think it was on a Saturday night, and we went out there every Saturday night, and it went on for about a year or maybe a little longer, and then Louis got sick, and he went to the hospital, he thought he had a bad case of the flu, was in the hospital, and found out he had leukemia, and 2 months later he died, and he... Louis was a young fellow, probably around 30, you know, and it was pretty heartbreaking for us because we had a small group and we were pretty tight, really, really tight people. in the early days, you know, if there was something to do, we did it. We didn't say the game was on TV and get somebody else, you know, or our grandma's in here from New York and we can't come. No, we put our grandma on hold and went, you know. And Mel Hellman and I, we used to go out to CRC, to the penitentiary there, held a meeting out there, and it was about 100 and some miles from where we lived, and we would go on a work day, you know, out there and get back at midnight or a little after and get up at 6-7 o'clock in the morning and go to work, and never thought about it, never complained about it, never said we were tired, you know. There was a dedication at that time that is really hard to explain, you know. It seemed like the more work we did, the less tired we became because we were dedicated to each other. And then some other meetings began to evolve. The meeting, I think the next meeting that started, and I'm not sure exactly time frame, but it was within that first couple years, was on Yuck and Gower in Hollywood. That was a meeting that was started by Paul Stewart and myself, and that went very well. But there was some conflicts with that too, because Sylvia, by that time, Sylvia and her brothers were there, and they were pretty determined about they wanted meetings in a certain way. And anyway, that was an open meeting, and one day somebody came in from the parole department and wanted to attend the meeting, and they called me, and I said, yeah, that's fine, because at that time, the reason they called me is because during that time, I think it was late 62 or something, Jimmy got real tired about the answering service, the central office, all that kind of stuff, and all he wanted to do was write and communicate with people in other states and other countries. And so he gave my wife Tilly and I the central office responsibilities. With the answering service, we moved it to our home in Sylmar there, and so that's why this fellow in the parole department called, and then my wife, she took calls from the wives and sometimes the husbands of wives that were having problems, and it was sort of, well, I don't know if you can call it Al-Anon, Nar-Anon, or whatever, but it was helping the relatives of the people with the drug problems, you know, and we didn't have a name for what she was doing at that time, but she was doing it, you know, and she spent many hours at night, late at night, doing that. And so anyway, but this guy called, and so we invited him to the meeting because it was an open meeting, and then Sylvie's brothers came, and they didn't like this guy because they had all been in jail and prison and stuff, and it wasn't compatible with where they were at. Anyway, we had a big ensuing argument and this, that, and the other thing, and then the next week they came back with a few of their friends, and the meeting was changed to a closed meeting.
Sounds like some things don't change.
Right, some things don't change, you know, and I think that's the way we spread. People get dissatisfied with this or that or the other thing, and then they go off and do something, and they do the right thing, you know. And we get closed meetings, open meetings, women's meetings, special meetings, this and that and the other thing, because everybody has a need, and for some reason we find that need. And that was sort of an explosion of NA at that time. And
So then it's still true that all you need to start a meeting is a resentment in a coffee pot?
Yeah. And you can get the coffee pot later. Sometimes we didn't have enough money for a coffee pot. But,
I hear you.
Yeah. So then the next meeting, so I think the thing that happened there too was that then Paul said, he told me, he says, hey, listen, I know about a place at the Royal Palms Hotel down in Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles. He said, I'm going to go down there and see about starting the meeting. So anyway, then we started the meeting at the Royal Palms Hotel. That was an open meeting. And it was really nice. And it was Sunday afternoon, and it was specifically wanted it open because it was a park. It was right next to a beautiful MacArthur Park. We could bring our families, and we could go to the meeting. Our families could go over with the kids and go to the park and everything. And so it was a real comfortable meeting. There was a fellow by the name there, a guy by the name of Frank Parquette, very significant guy. Another guy named Poncho, and Frank and Poncho were friends, but Frank started using morphine in the First World War. He was an old guy. This guy had no veins left. He could pull his legs up. All his veins were just scarred, you know, his arms and legs. And he was an old guy. I don't think he ever washed his face. He had sleepers in his eyes every time I seen him, you know. But he was the most gentle, caring human being I think that I've ever met besides Jimmy Kennan. And this guy, so he was there at the Royal Palms every meeting. In fact, he stayed just a little ways away there. But he liked to play the horses. And he played the 5-10 at Caliente in Mexico, and he won $90,000. Came back, $90,000, still had sleepers in his eyes, never changed a bit, same clothes, same everything, bought an apartment building, kept coming to the meetings, didn't change him a bit. Still, his main purpose was working with the newcomer. And that was a pretty amazing thing to see somebody like that, with that kind of integrity that wasn't moved by dollar bills, you know. So anyway, that was Frank. Well, anyway, the Mexican Mafia came in, Sylvia's brothers, and they brought their gang in, and they said, let's vote. So they voted to close the meeting because they wanted to close. And anyway, so what happened there, as far as I can remember, I think, we said, well, you know, you're going to have a closed meeting, but you can have it in the basement, and we'll have one here. So the meeting changed to the basement, and I think we kept the meeting upstairs. It was in like a sort of a bar with lounge chairs and stuff. But it was a bar, but the hotel, Royal Palms Hotel, was run by some sober alcoholics, and so there was no liquor there or anything. So. But anyway, so that's sort of what happened, and But that was, there was a lot of conflict there, you know, and that was the first 2 or 3 years in NA. And then what happened was my job changed, and I was moving from California to Oregon. And so Jimmy was pretty excited about that. And Jimmy said, hey, it's a couple guys, when you get to Oregon, I want you to contact these guys. You know, he says, I'm going to call them and write to them and tell them. Because he was communicating with James Drinkwater in British Columbia, Canada, and with Cookie, Harry Watson in Portland. And so when I got there, I started contacting these guys, and I got there in October of 74, and then so I was communicating with Harry Watts a little bit, but we were almost 300 miles apart. He was on the northern border, I was on the southern border, so we didn't associate a lot because of the distance. But in 1978, Cookie put on the first Pacific Northwest NA convention in Portland. And so I went to that, took a couple of friends of mine from Medford, and we went up there. It was a wonderful experience. And so then after the...
How many people were there?
I will say 150. Yeah.
A lot of people.
Yeah, that was a lot of people, yeah. And so anyway, when it was over, they said, well, I think we should have another convention, you know, who would want to do the next convention? And so there was nobody there. I think James Drinkwater was there in Canada. But I had been also visiting James Drinkwater. And he had a small apartment, sort of like Bill and Zona's place, you know, just a small little place. And he said, oh, yeah, we're having a meeting tonight, you know. And we waited and waited and waited. And pretty soon one guy showed up, you know. And he says, you know, it's really tough, Gene. He says, you know, sometimes we have 3 or 4 guys, sometimes we don't have anybody, you know. And so anyway, but James Drinkwater was there. But it was pretty obvious he couldn't have a convention in Canada because... He'd only have a half a dozen people show up. Well, maybe it's 50 or 100 people from Oregon. But the distance there was a problem, too. So anyway, after that convention, they said, well, who wants to have the next convention? So I wasn't even prepared for it, but I said, gee, we got a nice hotel down in Ashland, the Ashland Hills Inn. And so I said, yeah, we'll do it down there, you know. And I had never done anything like that before. And so anyway, we moved down there, and we had a real dedicated nucleus of NA members there. There wasn't many, but there was John Anderson and his wife, I wish I could remember all their names. Rick Jones and his wife. And they were probably the key people. And we put that together, or they did. I was the chairman. All I had to do was point the finger, which was great. But they had all the expertise. They did all the communicating, letter writing, and brochures and everything. And at that meeting, I mean, we sent out brochures to Northern California and Canada and Washington and at that meeting, we had 500 people there.
Wow.
It was amazing. It just, it blew everybody's mind. It was very well organized, not because I had anything to do with it, but just because people cooperated and the people at the facility were very, very cooperative. It was an excellent meeting. So, you know, that's probably the most significant thing that I know about the progression from 53 up to That was 1979 when we put on the last Pacific Northwest NA conference. And then I was on the board for a couple years of the regional committee. And but people started getting involved from Washington, from Canada, and there was a lot of activity. And Southern Oregon, where I was from, there was some activity, but it wasn't stimulated like it was in the northern part in Washington and in Canada. And so then I withdrew from the committee, and things sort of settled in the Seattle area. Portland, Seattle area is where it really started to develop. And since that time, then, because that developed, was very close to British Columbia, and James Drinkwater's initial involvement there and program just seemed to blossom, and now there's hundreds of people there and many, many meetings. And it all started with Jimmy, I think. These guys somehow found out, Cookie and James Drinkwater were the key people there, and I don't know how they began to communicate with Jimmy, how they found out about NA, but it was merely letter writing in the beginning, you know, and then it blossomed, people started moving in, and it grew just like it started growing in other directions, you know. I think one of the first things that there must be some information about that, but in 1962, Jimmy, and I think one reason that Jimmy gave us the central office, answering service and all that, and all the literature, was that he wanted to communicate especially with other countries. And at that time, in 1962, we were communicating with on a reel-to-reel tape with a group, an NA group in Sydney, Australia. It was made up of people in a medical...
Mario and those guys.
Yeah, I don't remember the names. So that was Mario.
Yeah, Mario and there was Garth and
Garth.
Right, and they're still involved. I saw them both at the World in San Diego.
Wow.
So they're still around, and Garth is still working with the Australian government to further recovery in Narcotics Anonymous. So it's pretty exciting that Jimmy's effect is still being felt out there, and Australia is growing the same way that the United States is in the rest of the world.
Right. That's from a small beginning, you know. And I can remember we sat there at the Friday night meeting on Rosen Moore Park and made those tapes, you know, of our meeting on an old reel-to-reel recorder that I eventually bought from Jimmy. It was an old Silvertone Sears recorder, tape to tape, and then he bought a Wolensack, which was the top of the line, you know, and boy, we were excited. Now we're in big business, you know, but that's what we did, and it was pretty exciting to communicate with another country, and so, like you said, that's still going. And
well, the interesting thing is I was walking through the convention hall in San Diego, and these guys pulled me over because they saw my name tag, and they were from South Africa.
Oh, yeah.
And the way that the fellowship in South Africa grew was from them getting speakers tapes from the World Service Office, and so they had a tape of mine, and it was just like, that made my whole convention, the fact that just anything I could have done anywhere had any effect anywhere else. And so the fellowship is still growing the way Jimmy started it growing back in the 50s and the 60s through tapes, through letter writing, through, now we have the internet, but it's still the same thing, one addict reaching out to another. It's been awesome, Gene. I'm going to give you a couple minutes to wrap up. Anything you want to leave as kind of a legacy to those people who are going to hear these tapes, who had no idea what the heck was going on until they got here? I know you talk a lot about how important contact is, and the contact you have with Mel, for instance, and some of the other people. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how important that still is to your recovery.
Well, yeah, you know, the most important in our recovery was the newcomer, the guy that was still suffering. And one of the blessings that Jimmy gave us, well, I think it came from our higher power, you know, was the first Christmas of 1962, February 25th. That night, Christmas night, about 12:30, Jimmy called me at home, got me out of bed. He said, Jimmy, Jane, he says, there's a guy down in Los Angeles, he needs to talk to somebody right away, having a hard time, he's in a hotel, show me where it was. So he says, can you get a couple guys and go? Yeah. So I went and I got Roger from down in Burbank. I called Bob McLaughlin, who was another fellow in the first days. He was in Long Beach. And I picked up Roger and Bob McLaughlin met us at the hotel. We spent the whole night with the guy. In the morning, we took him, tried to get him into a hospital. And then finally, we took him to his relatives, his brother's place, got him situated and everything. And then we went home to our families about 9 o'clock in the morning. And never bothered us. It was a joyful activity, you know. We never complained about, well, we had to get up in the middle of the night. We loved it. We loved it. Because we were doing our job. We knew what our job was.
So you feel that the people today who don't know what it feels like to get up in the middle of the night,
they miss something.
Yeah. Could you?
Yeah. They really miss something, you know. It seems like the TV, the sports activities, we have so many things to draw us away from going and helping another human being.
Kids, family.
Yeah, and Jimmy always stressed that, you know. In the beginning, Jimmy, you know, he always said, no matter what you do, you need to help the guy that's still hurting. And I'll tell you, Jimmy could be in the middle of something very, very important, and if somebody called that was still hurting, everything was dropped and he went directly to that guy. And I think that's the thing that that Jimmy really gave us, you know. Was the fact that the guy that's still hurting is the most important one. And I'll tell you what, I made a statement at San Diego. We had a guy there that was, he was at the convention, he was drunk, he crapped in his pants, he was laying there in front of the building, and people were just walking by. I took this guy, took him to my place, collected some money to get him some new clothes. We got him some new clothes. We got him, washed him up. And it took us about 8 hours before that. And then there was the main meeting on Saturday night. And, you know, and so all us sort of what you call important people, you know, were up there on the stage. And I took this guy, Tom, and I said, Tom, you're coming up on the stage with us. And Tom, I sat Tom between Chuck and I. And Chuck Gates and I were not the important people there. It was Tom. And I wanted to make a statement there that that's the guy we need to be concerned about. Not the guy that's the great speaker, but the guy that's still suffering. Mm-hmm. And that was a statement, I think, from me, but it really wasn't from me. That was a statement from Jimmy Kennan, because that's the way Jimmy Kennan felt. And hopefully we can carry on with his attitude toward helping the guy that's still suffering.
That's great. Thanks, Gene. That was awesome. Appreciate it.
I wish I could refer to you guys all day. And if you're going to be around town, we'll find a way to do it. But right now, Chuck and the phone are outside.
Oh, we're good.
Chuck's got a plane to catch.
All right.
Thanks so much.
That was awesome.
Okay.
Enjoyed it.
Well, I'll tell you what, I enjoyed it.